Yes, good. Yeah, so it's great to see many faces I know. Some faces from the past, I'm looking at Teresa's, and a few new faces that I haven't seen before. So yeah, very good to get to know the Sangha in Sweden. Yeah. So yes, like Vidyachandra said, I'm going to talk about the Bodhisattva ideal, the work in India. But I noticed I had difficulties with the title, because I found myself reflecting that, I couldn't really connect with the title, because I'm not in India specifically to be a Bodhisattva or to fulfill the Bodhisattva ideal. Yeah, I'm in India because I want to work there, and I think in those terms about my work. I just think of myself as somebody practicing the Dharma who wants to be in India, or who found herself in India. Yeah, because I feel that you can practice the Bodhisattva ideal wherever you are, in any situation you're in. But what I will do as I talk is perhaps, well, hopefully, out of my talk will become clearer what challenges me particularly in India. Yeah, so that the particular challenges I face in India as regards my own personal practice. So I thought I would just start off very, very generally about what the Bodhisattva ideal is, because I'm not sure how many people know about it. And then I'm going to talk about, we're no longer the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, are we? We're the Tri Ratna Buddhist community, or the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order, how we actually got our contact with India, yeah, how that came about, and how I ended up there, and what I'm doing there. And I just want to finish then with actually what challenges me in my practice as a Dharma wayfarer, yeah, in that situation. So yes, I want to start really with the order, the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order. So in the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order, many of you will know that we have as our myth the figure of a thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. And you could say it's not that the order are the arms of Avalokiteshvara, although that is often said. I think it's more precise to say that the order is the body of Avalokiteshvara. So the practice of the 10 precepts, the commitment to the three jewels, is the ever-deepening practice of the order. And that in a way, makes up the body of Avalokiteshvara. And the hands are a very natural, organic expression of the Bodhisattva ideal. So if you don't have a body, you won't have the hands. Yeah. And I think some people forget that. And I think it's very important in order to understand the Bodhisattva ideal that it's the body of Avalokiteshvara from which the hands come. The hands don't exist without the body. So the body is the practice, the collective practice within the order. And every contribution that an order member makes is that order member within his or her own conditions, within his or her own situation, contributing to this myth, contributing to alleviate suffering in the world. So that's the Bodhisattva ideal. And order members create a Buddha land. So you could say this centre here in Stockholm is a Buddha land. Dharmagiri is a Buddha land. Your work can be created. You can create conditions in your work so that there are aspects of the Buddha land there within your home situation. And when we create a retreat together, we're trying to create a Buddha land. If we take on a project here in the centre, we're trying to create a Buddha land. Even if it's, I know a team met this afternoon, people who look after the centre, who clean the centre, yeah? You're trying to create a Buddha land. So a land where the Dharma is practiced, where Sangha is created. And a Buddha land needs a lot of creativity. It needs people who see opportunities of getting people together, getting people motivated and stimulated by the Dharma, to practice the Dharma. And it needs people to reach out to a wide variety of people, not just people who would normally turn up here at the centre, but people who have a thirst for the Dharma, who would never think of coming down these steps through this door. And the Bodhisattva ideal, building the Buddha land, is what touches us as an order, is what moves us as an order. And it motivates us to practice the Dharma. And why is that? Because we have faith and conviction that the three jewels are the only true refuges. It's only through the three jewels that we can alleviate suffering, that we can free people from their bondages, however that is, if it's psychological, emotional, physical, spiritual, existential. So when you join the order, you don't join it just to have a little bit of help to or a little bit of support to develop yourself personally. You join it because the order has a mission. You sign up for a mission. You sign up to be part of the body of Avalokiteshvara. However your hand might come out, yeah, and where it might go, how it looks, you sign up for the body of Avalokiteshvara. And what we're doing, in a way, I think Bhante is very clever, in a way, Bhante Sangharakshita, the founder of the order, is very clever. Because he has developed this myth. He has, in a way, generated this myth within the order. Because it's through building a Buddha land and through developing our understanding and deepening our understanding and practice of the Bodhisattva ideal that we start to have a skillful means within our grasp to break down our own self-centeredness and self-reference, yeah, to use those terms. Or, yeah, wanting to practice the spiritual life to achieve something, to get something for ourselves. So some sort of material spiritualism. And that's the reason why I'm in this order. Because I have a means where I'm working on myself for the sake of others. Those two things go together for me. I'm not working on myself, and there happen to be others. I'm working on myself for the sake of other human beings. So I'm constantly challenged to push beyond my personal parameters, push beyond my personal boundaries again and again. And it's interesting, in terms of the body of Avalokiteshvara, and the hands as the natural expression of practice, that the last three precepts that the order members take at ordination are to, to destroy, I don't think that's too strong a word, to destroy greed, hatred and delusion or confusion or ignorance within their own practice. So, yeah, we're on a mission. The order is on a mission. So, recently, I've been doing some outline Mitra study for the Mitras in Germany. And we've been studying the Vimalakirti Nirdesha. And those of you who studied the Vimalakirti Nirdesha know that there's a lot in there about building the Buddha land and the Bodhisattva ideal. And what struck me, you know, it's interesting when you go back to something that you've studied many times, you think, I don't remember that before. And what struck me going back to it again with the mitras is this emphasis in the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, not on the Bodhisattva ideal as alleviation of suffering, yeah, of practicing karuna necessarily, but of sort of trying to alleviate pain and misery, go out towards the poor and the sick. But the emphasis is on about developing wisdom, about developing pranya. So the Bodhisattva develops wisdom. The Bodhisattva sees reality, sees what it means to be human, to understand and empathize with the human condition. So he responds from a pure sensitivity to the human condition in other humans, in other beings. And he responds to that from a joy, or she responds to that from a joy, because he or she is in contact, himself, herself, with reality. And there's a very interesting quote. It's a bit complicated, this quote. I've tried to simplify it. The quote is from Thurman, who translated the Vimalakirti Nirdesha into English. And in the glossary under Bodhisattva, he writes this, which I find just such a superb quote. So I have simplified it. It's not the exact words that he uses. And he talks about, in the Vimalakirti, there's a lot of mention of Maha Maitri, so great metta, great love, the Bodhisattva's love. And this is my notes now, that love usually means you can rely on things. They are true, they are real. But Maha Maitri, the love of the Bodhisattva, is superior, is greater, because it's a love born of wisdom. And Thurman says, great compassion, so Maha Maitri, is accompanied by the clear awareness that comes because there is no such thing as living beings. There's no such thing as suffering in reality. So the Bodhisattva has a sensitivity where there is no dualistic notion of subject and object. Such compassion is pure sensitivity, with no cognitive grasp on any person or thing as the object of a powerful feeling. The Bodhisattva's love is not merely, or not just, commiseration. Yeah? Commiseration? Sort of empathy with misery, yeah? It's not merely this commiseration, but a spontaneous overflow of his or her great joy and relief in realizing the radiant nature of reality. Although he or she grasps at no living being, he or she, being empty of him or herself, is completely sensitive to the oppressive nature of the living being feeling of others. And his and her love is an outpouring of their awareness of their true nature. So nowhere in that is talk about moving towards people because they suffer as such, but moving towards people because to be a living being has an oppression. Yeah? And it's the pranya of the Bodhisattva that sees that oppression, that understands that oppression. And I got very stimulated by understanding a little bit more that the emphasis in the Bodhisattva ideal is on wisdom, not necessarily on karuna. Because in the Vimalakirti, the theme is illness, We all know that, if we've read it, that Vimalakirti is ill because all living beings are ill. So we are all ill. Yeah. We're oppressed as living beings. We are oppressed by our living beingness. We're in samsara. And it's because of that that the bodhisattva responds. So this has given me quite a lot of reflection about my own work in India. Really made me look at things in a slightly different light. So what I'm going to do now, because I'm not sure how much of you know, I'm going to talk a little bit about how we, the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order, came to have an order and a movement also in India. Yeah, and I think the fact that we have an order and a movement in India is very much part of Bhante Sangharakshita's vision. A lot of you have read and know that poem where he says, "I can be, what I believe is that I can be a friend to anybody, whoever they are." Do you know that? Do you remember that poem? And this poem is very, very moving. He deeply believes that it's possible to be a friend to anybody. And therefore, I think the fact that we have an order and a movement in India is part of this vision, part of what Bhante believes in. And as many of you have read and know, there was one very famous person in India called Dr. Ambedkar. And he came from untouchable origins in Maharashtra. And untouchable means that you are not within the four castes in India. You are under the lowest caste. You're an unscheduled caste. And caste comes about because of the Hindu religion. So if you're a good Hindu, you practice casteism. And it was a way of controlling the population of India, that people had various occupations, various possibilities within India. If you're born in a caste, you stay in a caste. There's no way of getting out of that caste, and you're reborn in it again and again and again. So there's something very cruel about the caste system, just in that itself. Dr. Ambedkar came from the untouchable caste. And through a lot of generosity and his own intelligence and sensitivity, he actually worked his way up academically so that he ended up with scholarships and degrees from America and from England, and I think maybe possibly from other places in Europe. But he became a highly regarded academic. And he was, in fact, partly responsible for writing the Indian constitution, which is used even nowadays, which actually is a fantastic constitution. The problem with the Indian constitution is it is marvellous, it's just very, very difficult to apply. for reasons that I won't go into now. So Dr. Ambedkar, for 20 years, he looked around for various means and ways in which he could free his people as he saw them. So the ex-untouchables in India. And he worked unceasingly. So he never stopped working for his people. So he worked politically. He looked around for different religions, different philosophies. And this took him 20 years before he himself became a Buddhist in 1956. And he said, "I was born a Hindu, but I will not die a Hindu." And it was the teachings of the Dharma that he felt gave his people the greatest opportunity to free themselves from their casteism, to free themselves from the oppressions under which they were living. So when he converted in 1956, 500,000 of his followers converted with him. So that's pretty normal in India. If you've been to India, you know that Indians seek leaders. And if their leader does something, they will all follow. Yeah, because there's such faith and devotion in that. So Dr. Ambedkar, and this is important for us to know, sometimes I'm a little shocked, I must say, that people don't know this in Europe. Dr. Ambedkar sits on the refuge tree in India. Yeah. Dr. Ambedkar is seen as a bodhisattva and a teacher. Whether you agree with that is, you can make your own minds up, but that's how he's seen in India. And he sits on the refuge tree. So all the mitras, all the order members who do this practice, they also prostrate to Dr. Ambedkar. On every shrine, wherever you go in India, you will see a huge picture of Dr. Ambedkar and a huge picture of Bhante Sangharakshita. If you go into somebody's house, there's a huge picture of Dr. Ambedkar. Yeah. And since being in India and living in India with my Indian brothers and sisters and seeing the devotion that they have for Dr. Ambedkar and that how much they read about him, how they know his teachings, I feel he's not only a teacher for my Indian brothers and sisters, he's also my teacher, along with Bhante Sangharakshita. And if you read anything about Dr. Ambedkar's views on social views, on community, you will see that Bhante has taken many of his ideas about the Sangha from Dr. Ambedkar. So what was extremely sad for the ex-untouchables, they became Buddhist, they freed themselves from their casteism, but within 6 months of that first conversion, Dr. Ambedkar died. And Bhante Sangharakshita had a friendship with Dr. Ambedkar. And when he realised the situation, because people were distraught, they had lost their leader, they had lost actually their hero, yeah, the person who was going to save them. When Bhante realised this, he actually went round Maharashtra and other areas of India giving talks and not only teaching the Dharma, but consoling people. And you have to remember, these people did not know the Dharma. They knew Hinduism, but they did not know the Dharma.
The consoling.
Consoling. They were in grief, yeah. They were in grief, yeah. Comforting them, yes, a good word, yeah. So there's a lot of basic Dharma teaching that Bhante had to do. And through this, he made many friends. And he made visits over the years to India. And I'm moving on very quickly now. In the late 70s, one of Bhante's disciples, someone I think who's been here to Sweden and given talks, Lokamitra? Yeah. Lokamitra went out to Pune to do Iyengar yoga, because Mr. Iyengar of Iyengar yoga lives in Pune. And Bhante said to him, oh, well, when you go to Pune, look up these people. These are my friends. They will help you. Yeah, they will. You can just make sure they're okay. And Lokamitra not only went to Pune to do Iyengar yoga, he ended up living there, yeah, and he still lives there, and he's married now with two children. But in a way, Lokamitra's contact with these friends slowly crystallized as the beginning of the order there. And Bhante says of Lokamitra that what Lokamitra has managed to do in India, Bhante himself couldn't do. Lokamitra is one of the giants in our order. So what happened was Lokamitra realized that it wasn't a question of just teaching the Dhamma to the ex-untouchables. They needed to be lifted out of their misery. They needed to be lifted out of their dreadful housing, out of their oppression, out of their, what can I say, the habits that went with that caste. So a lot of the habits that went with their caste were alcoholism, for instance, unemployment, unethical behaviour, that they needed to be lifted. It wasn't a question of just giving the Dharma. Their social situation, their political situation had to change. So what happened was, as the order grew in India, Dharmacharis, because there were only Dharmacharis then, it took a while for women to get ordained, the Dharmacharis began to work full-time in social and Dharma projects in India. But that needed money. So Banti encouraged the order members in the West to raise funds. So that's how Karuna started, or in those days it was called Aid for India. And what happened was that people went round, in the beginnings it was round London, and knocked on people's doors and asked for money. And they asked for, what are they called in English, standing orders. Yeah, so a regular donation over 3 or 5 years. I did that work in the early 80s for 3 months in London. I'll come on to that a little bit later. Those appeals still continue. That's the way that Karuna gets its money for India. And at the moment, there's 1 year-long appeal going on. Yeah, I don't quite know in which city. Maybe some of you know. Does anybody know? Or maybe in a few cities. I'm not quite sure. I know Abhilasha has got this. He's the chair of Karuna. He's got this year-long appeal running. And, we have to take on board that a percentage of the order lives in India. Yeah? And a percentage of the movement is in India. So, yes, this is something that moves me and touches me very deeply, that even though we have completely different cultures, if you've been to India, it is like another universe. It's another planet. There's no way you can really compare it with Europe. But nevertheless, we are one order, we are one movement. And this is challenging for us because our Indian brothers and sisters are practicing the Dharma for very different reasons than we do. In the West, we're quite preoccupied with ourselves, yeah? And we come along to a centre, usually, because there's some dissatisfaction in our lives. We want something more in our lives. Or we've got some existential crisis. But in the East, in India, people practice the Dharma to free themselves of their oppressions. And you could say it's the same for us in another way, which is true. But in the East, it's social and political reasons. And they're doing it as a community. So they're not freeing just themselves out of that. They're freeing the whole of their community out of that oppression. And I think this is a challenge to take this on board and to realise that people are practising the Dharma, the same Dharma as we practise, the same ethics as we practise, chant the same chants. But the reason why they're doing it is got another emphasis than ours. So it's like taking on board another world, but still connecting with the fact that here are human beings in their own human situation. They're still experiencing dukkha. And one of my friends, one of my Indian friends, Sharda, she's a Mitra who's asked for ordination, she gave a very moving life story. And she's had a pretty horrific life. Just to give you a taste of one thing that stays in my mind about her life story is she lived in a tree for a while, eating banana skins. And Sharda told her life story. And at the end of it, she said, "I practice the Dharma, I go for refuge in order to be a human being." And this, yeah, just, whoops, my microphone. This really gets to me. Yeah, this really touches me. So I'm hoping that when we do all have this one name, yeah, Triratna, that the fact that we're on different planets, we're on different different universes, but we are one movement, we are one order, and that what we're practicing, what is important to us, is also what our Dharma, our Indian brothers and sisters are practicing, is what is equally important to them. And on Sri Dayachandra's ordination retreat in 2005, well, Ratnasara was there as well, on their ordination retreat, I don't know if you two remember, but there were two talks. There was one by Vandana Jyoti, who's a British order member, and there was one about from an Indian order member, whom I can't remember now who it was, and they talked about their reasons for practicing the Dharma. And it was so obvious that there were two different worlds, but they were being ordained into the same order. Yeah, Vandana Jyoti talked very much about being a lack of self-confidence, a lack of direction in her life, an existential crisis, a relationship that had gone wrong, a marriage that had gone wrong. And the Indian order member, I don't know who she was now, but I remember very, very clearly that she talked about wanting to lift herself out of her caste, lift herself out of her oppression. And she wanted to lift her community out of their oppression. So how did I come to get involved in India? Well, I went along to the Manchester Centre when I was just a friend in about 1981. And I hadn't been there very long when some people came from the London Buddhist Centre and gave a talk about, as it was then, Aid for India. And there was something about this talk. I was just very, very deeply moved by this talk. And I had already connected with India during my life in just very small ways. I loved the music. I loved the food. there's something about that. I loved other cultures. I just found other cultures really refreshing. Yeah. And that I'd read some Indian poetry. I think Tagore. I don't know. It might have been. Yeah, I think it was Tagore I had read. But I was quite clear that I never wanted to go to India. And the thought of going to India made me really scared. And I remember I did go to Southeast Asia in the late 70s. And I did all I could to avoid India. I used to fly all sorts of routes to avoid going even over India. I was so frightened of going to India. I don't know. It just was, for me, the idea of a nightmare, you know, to go to this country. it's funny, isn't it? But when these two people came up from the London Buddhist Centre and talked about needing people to go and knock doors for Aid for India, I felt, I can do that. I can knock doors. You know, that's not, I can just go around and knock doors and ask people for money. You know, that's not a lot, is it? So I signed up. And down I went to London and knocked doors for 3 months for Aid for India. And one of the attractions was not only knocking the doors and feeling, yeah, I could do that, was also that we were living together in a women's community, which I wanted to do. And it turned out that our team, but there were only four of us, we were also the first women's team to go on the streets of London and door knock. And every night I knocked, I don't know, we had to knock 100 doors every night. Things have changed. But in those days, we had to knock 100 doors every night. And, yeah, at every door where they opened the door, I would give them this brochure. And on the cover of the brochure was a picture of a little boy. I remember it very clearly. And I would talk about our work in India. And something about doing that every night for 3 months stayed with me very, very strongly. So for me, I've had a strong desire all my life to be socially engaged. For me, it was not enough just to practice the Dharma for my own personal development. And I remember when I was 18 years old, I signed up for the VSO, the Voluntary Service Overseas. Yeah, I wanted to go to Africa. I wanted to change the world. I wanted to give. I wanted to share. I wanted to work with others. I wanted to help others to help themselves. This was so strong in me. I didn't end up in Africa, actually. Many of my friends did. But I ended up at university doing a lot of socially engaged work and getting a lot of other people to do it as well. So there was a very, very strong drive to be socially engaged. When I got involved in the FWBO as it was then, that was about 1981. And from 1981 to 2004, I had enough to keep me busy. Yeah, Fridaya Chandra mentioned Taraloka. So I was involved with Taraloka, setting that up. And then when I got ordained, I went back to I had been living in Germany, and I went back to Germany to start women's activities there. So, yeah, I was involved in building Buddha lands. But this itch for more social engagement was still there. It wasn't enough for me just working within the Sangha, in a way. I did what I could within the conditions which were there, but I was constantly looking for ways to take the Dharma out. So even in Essen, which is where I'm based in Germany, I went out and I taught in women's situations. So there were many, I can't remember what you call them now, refugees, women's refugees, women's centres. I taught meditation, or I talked about the Dharma. I wanted to meet women who would never come to a Buddhist centre. I didn't want just to be constantly seeing white middle-class people, yeah? I wanted something else. I wanted other cultures. I even ended up teaching the Dharma to Muslim women, yeah? So I went to lots of women's centres in Essen. I went to rehabilitation centres. I went to women's prisons. I taught women to read and write. This was very important to me, to take the Dharma out to women who would never, ever, ever think about coming to a Buddhist centre. And I had a very good response, a very good response. And I think also becoming an Anagarika was part of this, which is me wearing this gold kesa. And because it's very important for me not to be exclusive, yeah. Not to, I wanted to be inclusive. I wanted to include as many different people as possible in their contact with the Dharma or in their contact with me. I wasn't interested in being special to someone, and I wasn't interested in wanting somebody special in my life. I didn't want this exclusivity. I wanted to be as inclusive as possible. So for me, becoming an Anagarika was also another way in for me practicing the Bodhisattva ideal. And I have to say this, I mean, maybe I've missed things that are happening in Britain. I'm not always up to date with what's happening in Britain. So I'm going mainly on my experience in Germany. With the exception of one or two projects, which includes, we have a Karuna Germany. I know you're about to think about a Karuna Sweden, yeah? So supporting projects in India. With that exception, it's a source of sadness and disappointment to me that we don't have more socially engaged Buddhism in the Triratna or the FWBO in Europe. I know there's much more socially engaged Buddhism in America, particularly around the San Francisco FWBO Center. But I don't know quite, we haven't hit it here in Europe yet. I think other religions are much further ahead than we are. I think Buddhism lags behind here. And I'm happy also that I've heard here in Sweden, Ratnasara's told me that you talked to me about a weekend retreat you had here for people, I think, who'd been in AA. Is that right? Was it you who talked to me about it? So there is that engagement. Breathworks, I think, is a socially engaged project. And like I say, you're thinking of starting Karuna Sweden. So I think we need more of those. We need to go out, yeah, not just stay here in the nest, in the Sangha nest. Yeah, go out. Take the Dharma out. That aspect of socially engaged Buddhism needs to be a dynamic part of every mandala. There are many, many people wanting the Dharma, searching for the Dharma. They would not come to a centre. And there are many people not interested in the Dharma, but they need support. They need support to become more human, to live a human life, to experience freedom from oppressions. So for me, that urge became stronger and stronger over the years. There's lots to do in the Sangha in Germany, lots to do. But I wanted a bigger perspective, I wanted a bigger dimension to my life, a bigger dimension of activity in the world. And the only place for me to get that was India. Yeah? So I went to India. And the work that I do is mostly with women. So I take part in a variety of activities, all of which contribute to helping and supporting women to run their own social and Dharma projects. And they run them for ex-untouchables and other non-scheduled castes and tribals. So you have to remember, amongst the untouchables themselves, there are about 200 different castes. And then you go downwards. Yeah, down to the tribals and the nomads. So I teach them skills to run their projects, everything from getting a budget together, getting a work planner, doing an assessment report, yeah, making a project proposal. I do a lot of mediation, I do a lot of team building, how to write an agenda, how to write minutes, how to hold a meeting, yeah, all that sort of stuff. So we call it in India, we call it capacity building. I also do some Dharma work. So I lead or I support, how it's turned out, it's mostly meditation retreats and GFR retreats. So a GFR retreat, there are 800 women and 800 men who've asked for ordination in India. So if you put on a GFR retreat for women, expect 150 women. Yeah, and also expect some percentage of those who've come because they've heard there's a retreat on and they've not asked for ordination. They're not even mitras. Some of them don't even know very much about the Dhamma. Yeah. But they're part of that 150. You don't send them home. You just somehow include them. And they come with their veils over their faces from the village. And little by little, their veil goes back over the week. And I also teach the Dharmacharis and the Dharmacharinis things like how to, new ideas, how to take mitra study, or new ideas, how to lead retreats. Yeah, so help them develop their skills as study leaders and retreat leaders. So that's what I do. But I want to come back to this point about the Bodhisattva ideal, the emphasis on prajna, the emphasis on wisdom there. And I think that's a real challenge and a real informer for work in India. because there's just so much suffering. If you go out of your house, or I go out of my house to buy a litre of milk down the road, within that 5 minutes, I've met suffering in many, many forms. You could practically write a book about the 10 minutes leaving your house to get me your milk. And if I'm not careful, I can respond to that suffering, which is all around me in India, with guilt, with frustration, with impatience, with horrified anxiety, or wanting to get rid of it, wanting to ignore it. And I have to look deeper all the time for another response. And I'm challenged to find a response that meets their living being quality. Yeah, not just what gets to me or what I find difficult, but actually respond to them as living beings. And I don't always make it. Often I just shut down because it's too much. Or I think to myself, actually, I think what when I'm going past the slums, we have lots of slums around where we live. And when I'm going past the slums, you know, I can find this voice going through my head. Oh, my God, I'm glad I don't live like that. Oh, I'm glad I don't live like that. How can they do it? How can they do it? Yeah, it's all about me. So I have to keep going deeper for another response, which is to do with them being living beings. So for me, the Bodhisattva ideal is not about just giving to the poor and needy. It has to go deeper. It's about living beings needing dignity, needing humanness, meeting them as humans, and allowing them freedom to be human. So in India, I try to give to the beggars. There's so many beggars on the street. Yeah, there's so many people asking you for money, particularly if you've got a Western face. I don't know how they see you, but they see you and they just run and grab hold of you, yeah? Want money. They don't let go. And, you know, you've got to find somewhere a response to that. And I find that really difficult. And I keep changing my strategy every week, how I deal with it, yeah? It's not, you know, and sometimes I just decide, I'm not giving. And then that doesn't feel right either. So all the time I'm changing my strategy. And also for me, it's important when I give a beggar some rupees that I also give him back his humanness, yeah? That I also give him his dignity. So in India, there's a whole culture of keeping the oppressed oppressed. It works politically, yeah? If you keep the oppressed oppressed and then you promise them all sorts of things, they will vote for you. So there's a lot of keeping the oppressed oppressed in India, politically. And there's a lot that's working on your guilt. And that's the way that people get money. And it's a really tough decision that, you know, that all of us who are involved in India, it's a tough decision about what does it mean to support? What does it mean to support people in India? So I'm coming to the end now, and I just want to give a few examples of how I try and support in India. So these are my everyday things. I perhaps won't include them all, but I'll include one or two to give you just a sense of what I'm challenged with in my own practice. So this sort of seeing this suffering, whatever it is, whatever form it takes, I notice that it's so easy to just to want to rush in and help, particularly if I'm working with the women. I want to rush in and help the women in their projects. I want to do things for them. I end up sometimes, if I'm not careful, doing their work. Oh, Kulanandi, can you just do this for me? You can speak English. You can write English. You do this for me. Yes? So if I'm not careful, I just rush in there and do it, yeah? And I call it, it's my own little sort of way of saying it, you know, I end up holding their hands, yeah? which might sometimes be important to hold their hands, but sometimes it's just not very helpful. And I have to say stop to myself. Is this the best way to help them? Perhaps I would help them by letting them make mistakes, yeah, getting stuck, finding their own solutions. So I'm forced to keep stepping back, not rushing in. So what do these women need to develop? What do they need to develop as human beings? To deepen their awareness of being a human being, to deepen their self-confidence. So pranya, as my base, challenges me to constantly keep a bigger perspective, what it means to be human. And keep looking at my own motivations, why I want to help, yeah, why I'm rushing in to help. Maybe I think, oh, I've got some quick solutions up my sleeve here. If they only did these things, there'd be no problems. I want to make the situation easy for myself. Bye-bye. Nice to see you. or it's my horrified anxiety, my panic. But I've learned that building a Buddha land means having a very loose focus and not having a too quickly formed or too rigid form or idea of what I need to achieve, of how I can be effective. Because I've learned in India, I have no idea what I'm achieving with these women. I have no idea whether I'm even effective with these women. And I think often, and I said this to Arika today when we were talking, that actually I think what I'm doing, the conditions that I'm bringing in my being into India, I will not see the effects of those conditions in my lifetime. Yeah, I have no idea, in a way, what I'm doing in India. I'm just trying to deal with the moment, allowing conditions to build, to come towards me. And if I allow conditions, if I allow pratityasamutpada, yeah, to take its course, conditioned co-production to take its course, then I have a much wider palette, a much wider scala of opportunities and possibilities. If I try and get in there and control and manage, and think, you know, this needs to be done, that needs to be achieved, this is how I can be effective, I won't be helping India. All I can do is to look and listen. Look for and find a door to open a door for these women. Perhaps to open a door that they themselves are not able to see at that minute. But to do that, I have to be fully present. My ego has to be soft and in the background. My views, my ideas and my expectations have to be soft. And I know that when I'm at my best, I manage this. I can just find that door for them and open it a little bit and allow them to go through. And it's their door, and it's them going through that door. And when I'm at less than my best, I don't manage it at all. Then my ego's there, yeah? I've got these ideas. I'm pushing and shoving from the back, yeah? Another very important thing for me in my work, and keeping pranya as my emphasis, is that I live with four or five other Western Dhammacharinis in a community. And all of us are there quite clearly to work for the order and the movement in India. There's no other focus, there's no other emphasis. So when something goes wrong between us, when there's some sort of disagreement or some frustration or some conflict, and there's always that. Where there are people, there are always some sort of friction. And we're all very, very different, and we all can get on each other's nerves quite well. What happens is, if there is a disagreement and a conflict, we become immediately aware of it, and within minutes we have confessed and clarified something. We sorted it out between us. Because we cannot afford in our work for any long-standing polarizations or any bad moods or any disagreements or any disconnections to be there for any longer than is necessary. And that's for the sake of our work, yeah? For the sake of others. So nothing can stand in our way. Nothing can be allowed to get in our way. And this is a quality that I value very much with my Western Dhammacharini sisters. At the forefront of our work, at the forefront is our work and our work for others. And everything else is secondary. So it's a real challenge, this work in India, to move away from the personal, yeah? My little personal hurts, yeah? My little personal upsets, my little world, the things that I find difficult. And really to look out to a universal perspective. And India demands this of us, yeah? And it's great. It really demands it of you. And we actually, I would say all the time, or 99.9% of the time, we actually meet that demand because our work is so important to us. Okay. Maybe I'll finish there, because the last thing I was going to say, I realised when I was writing it, it's very much work in progress for me. And as I was writing it, I thought, I don't think I've really got to the bottom of this, that what I'm trying to say. So I think I'll finish here, because I don't want to finish with a slightly unclear point that might be as unclear for you as it is for me. But it is along the lines of, in a way, yeah, moving away from my self-centeredness, yeah, moving away from my ego-centeredness and moving away from my self-reference. And the last sentence I've got, I do want to read, actually, because I just want to thank my Dharma brothers and sisters in India, actually, really wholeheartedly, for the opportunity to deepen my practice. So I'll finish on that note. Yeah.